Welcome to the Amplifying Optimism in Education podcast, where we connect with educators from across the globe who are creating a better future for learning and educating now by implementing bold ideas and fostering a sense of curiosity, creativity, and possibility.
All right, welcome to the Amplifying Optimism in Education podcast. We're joined with my fellow co-host, Michael Carson. Today, we are honored to have Allison Gilmeister here with us. She is a founding member of Capital Experience Lab School and an all-around ingenious person who has wonderful ideas about how we can change education for the better as we move forward. So Allison, welcome, and thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Allison.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So first and foremost, just tell us a little bit about how you're filling your days.
Yeah, things are busy, just as they were before COVID, with a lot of the same things, like planning learning experiences for kids, also connecting with some students and families. I have really enjoyed the opportunity to connect with some former students who have reached out during this time. I got a great text message last week from a high school senior who was going through his old emails and found a email related to a project he had done when he was in eighth grade, and he took it upon himself. Yeah, he took it upon himself to text me. He texted me a screenshot of the email and was like, "Oh, I found this. It reminded me of way back when, and I just wanted to say hello."
How long ago was the email project from?
It was 4 years ago. He was in eighth grade. He's a senior in high school now. It totally made my week. So just connecting with kids and families, and as well as planning for learning experiences related to CapEx. And that's keeping us pretty busy.
Yeah. That's exciting. What was the project?
So it was a capstone project at Center City Public Charter Schools, where I worked for a long time. And capstone was their end of the year opportunity for teachers to really pull on the core values, character excellence and service, and then also do some project-based learning. At that point, the regular curriculum did not have a PBL focus, but every year at Capstone, we would have the chance to work in that way. And I had a friend of mine was working on food security at that time, and she was connected with Roger Thoreau, who's a journalist who wrote a book about the first 1,000 days of life and the importance of nutrition during that time. So because she had that contact and knew that we might be able to get the kids to meet him, we ended up designing our capstone project around that theme.
Pretty awesome.
So that's what the project was on. And so I got this student had done a social media campaign, among other things. And so he texted me some screenshots from his whole social media campaign.
Love it.
That's really cool. You've been doing project-based learning PBLs for a long time though. Can you talk just kind of about your experience with that? Because obviously from this text message that you got, it proves the impact it has on students. So talk to us a little bit about that experience that you've had and what drew you to that type of teaching.
I think that at the end of the day, it comes down to engagement and kids feeling like they have a real purpose and that their work is meaningful and that it's not only for their teacher, that it moves them towards a goal that they want to achieve, whether it's a message they want to spread to an audience or some community impact that they want to make, that makes the work real to them. And then the other piece is since PBL allows kids to work towards a project that is bigger, I think it, like anything, like for any, I don't know, for all humans, I think we want to work on something that we feel like can last and isn't just something we can like throw into the recycling bin at the end of the day. Yeah. So I feel like when kids have been doing a lot of work that's limited in scope to maybe like a 15-minute assignment that they do on a single piece of paper, and then they may or may not get feedback on, and then they recycle it. when that is in contrast to something that they work on over a period of weeks, that they get a lot of feedback on, that has a public audience, that they share beyond their classroom, they're super excited to do something that's more real.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that feedback part of it too? Because I think that's often, right, the criticism is, well, how do you know that they're doing well? It's just a project. And, you know, I know obviously the importance of rubrics and things like that. Can you talk just a little bit about how you work on the mastery side of a project-based learning experience?
So I think that when I'm assessing, or other teachers I've worked with are assessing in the context of a project, we're looking at evidence of student thinking that comes from all of the steps along the way that go into the final product. And we're also listening to the student talk about both what they learned and their process. And it's really in some of those conversations that we're able to assess how deeply the student knows the material. So the rubric is definitely essential for communicating to an external audience and for the kid knowing himself or herself, like, what do I need to do to go to the next level? Mm-hmm. But there's a big piece of the puzzle, which is listening to how students talk about their work. And there's just a huge difference between listening to somebody who's really fluent about a topic because they've read a lot about it, they've talked to other people about it, maybe watched videos about it, they've done their own thinking about it. There's a huge difference between that conversation and a conversation where a student doesn't feel comfortable with the material.
Yeah. And I imagine, Allison, too, I'm just kind of thinking for teachers who maybe aren't doing a lot of project-based learning, what's that transition like when students come in or families come in and they're not used to project-based learning and this type of, you know, kind of rubric assessment where you're holistically looking at their learning rather than, you know, stamping a grade on a test? What's that transition like? How does that go?
I do think that teachers have a lot of influence on how smoothly that transition goes. And a lot of the same best practices that help a classroom run smoothly and help kids feel secure and help them feel successful in a traditional setting also work in PBL. So clear direction, just about like, okay, this is our goal.
Right.
Even if we don't say that the goal is to complete, you know, this paper, if we're really clear about like, this is the goal and this is more or less how we're going to get there, and these are some steps you can take, you can offer that and still leave room for student choice and student planning. But at the beginning of your PBL journey, it's beneficial, in my experience, to offer a little bit more of that in terms of like where we're going. Mm. And then as kids develop the skills to navigate themselves, then you can open up more and more and let them set more of the direction. But I find that it's helpful at the beginning to like create the sandbox a little bit.
Yeah.
And then say, we're playing in here.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that metaphor of the sandbox. Like, not the entire beach. We're just going to start here. And I, you know, as you were saying that, I thought of just the other metaphor of like, you know, when I was learning how to ride a bike, there were training wheels and then I took them off. And I can't ride a bike, just so you know, without training wheels now. So, you know, but yeah, I love that. So sounds like kind of that. I love what you said, that it's like, it's not this totally different thing for teachers, this skill that they have to completely master. The many elements of good teaching, apply to project-based learning. Now, another question I have about that would be from the teacher side, what's that transition like for teachers? Because I think there are a lot of, you know, in more sort of a standard learning environment, there are a lot of practices that actually don't really nourish and nurture project-based learning. Have you seen that play out in terms of teachers kind of learning how to function and in the project-based learning environment?
Yeah. Do you have a specific example in mind? I'm just curious if you're thinking of certain practices.
Well, and I think it's, and what brought that question to mind was when you said, you know, you start out with, you know, a little more clear direction, some more steps that the students can take and then ease away. And I think about how sometimes, you know, teachers that are new to a more open learning environment struggle with, you know, maybe not giving quizzes or tests, or struggle with, student freedom in terms of their time or their schedule or changing things up and things like that. And maybe that's just in my head that would be a problem in transition, but that's kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah, I think that when we're working with people, for example, with CapEx teachers who might be new to PBL, mm-hmm. we always look at learning experiences and ask, how do they serve the project? And mm-hmm. so if a quiz helps kids master vocabulary that they then need to use in their project, fine, get a quiz, no yeah. problem. But yeah. it's always about framing it and like, what is the quiz? What is it for? The quiz is an opportunity for you to self-quiz, which helps the information right. stick in your head. And then you're going to do this retrieval practice on the quiz, which is going to make you master the vocabulary so that you sound like an expert when you do your interview with the guest mm-hmm. who's coming next week. Mm-hmm. So it's all about the why. And so like, we're not doing a quiz just to have a grade or to fill time.
Yeah.
And like, if there's not a reason for the practice in the context of the project, yeah. then that provides a reason to let it go.
Yeah.
But if teachers can explain or justify to the kids and the team, like why mm-hmm. this practice helps the class move or the individual student move towards the goal, mm-hmm. then we're good.
Yeah. So it's starting with the why. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much that, I guess what I'm hearing is it's not so much that a new teacher in a project-based learning kind of environment would not be able to bring those things in. It's just a question of to what end. And I guess so really what I was thinking about is, you know, that shift from we're doing it because it's the routine, we're doing it because that's what schools do, we're doing that because we need a grade, you know, we haven't had one in a week or something in the grade book, and more as to, okay, so this is the project we're working on, and this is really where students could use some support and encouragement, you know, and that's mm-hmm. kind of the why.
And that aligns, I think, really well with why I believe really strongly in project-based learning as a tool to support all students, including mm-hmm. students who have disabilities and students who learn differently and students who are learning English. Whereas some people feel like though, some people say like, okay, project-based learning is for quote unquote advanced students mm-hmm. who don't need as much support. And it's really that focus on the goal and then the ability to flexibly adjust the activities to get the kids to the goal. That's mm-hmm. why it's such a good fit mm-hmm. for diverse learners. Because if we like need to create this project that we have in mind, yeah. there are multiple pathways to get there. And so different kids who have different needs could take a little bit more time or a little less time, or could work with a partner, or could do mm-hmm. it by themselves, mm-hmm. Or could type it on the computer, or could write it by hand, depending mm-hmm. on what they need in order to show mastery on the project.
Yeah.
I love this idea of, again, the project, I think, is also, it keeps the student in mind, right? Because each project has the same rubric that you're looking for the skills that you're trying to teach and have students master, but it looks very different from student to student. So I think that that's where, I mean, when we think about fostering creativity, I'm wondering what you see in terms of, by allowing students to have different projects, but the same rubric, what mm-hmm. kind of creativity do you notice amongst your students?
I definitely notice a couple of things. One, this isn't exactly creativity, but just student pride in their own expertise really stands out. And that they can develop that expertise and they can really notice it compared to their classmates, because they and their classmates might have chosen something slightly different. And so if we're all like studying the exact same thing, like we all have the same list of spelling words, and then we like have some sort of competition, then there's this ranking that happens on how we all know the same words. But when CapEx did a project called Chemistry on the Mall and kids on the National Mall, kids generated questions about things that they observed either walking around the mall or in museums on the mall that they could answer using evidence from a chemical perspective. So like looking at a molecule and its structure and why it did certain things. So for example, kids ask things like, why does chlorine clean water based on the tidal basin? Or, okay, we walk by a food truck on the way to the museum and they're like, why do hot peppers make your mouth burn? Or why are some rocks phosphorescent? They all had different questions. Why does Botanic Gardens has a glass roof? Why does Windex clean glass? Right? They had all these different, really, really different questions. And they had complete, they developed specialized knowledge related to chemistry in order as they worked on their questions. And then they eventually did their writing pieces, but they also had demos that helped show and introduce their classmates to the aspect of chemistry that they had specialized in. So there wasn't really an app, like an apples to apples comparison to say like student A is like way outperforming student B, because student A and student B were doing different, had different questions. And so each had something to teach the other. And there also wasn't anyone else in the room who could really necessarily speak to that topic. And so there was definitely motivation to try to develop that expertise as strongly as possible, because kids have real questions for each other. And so when they would ask each other, they couldn't look around and say, well, so-and-so will answer. Nope. You got it. So if you don't know, you can go find out and we'll ask you again tomorrow.
And I think there's something special about that culture that you create, because I think that's often the, again, just to go back to why school might not function that way or might not consider that, it's that you have to remember that the community and the way that students relate will shift as well, and that they'll be curious about each other. And they'll be like you said, well, I better, you know, really study this Windex thing on these windows, because I'm going to get some questions from my other, my classmates, and I want to look good. I want to teach them something.
It's fun, right? It's just fun. It's fun to be knowledgeable. It's fun to have something to share. It's fun if you figure out that like Windex is related to soap, and you start learning about polar molecules, and you come up with some cool demos related to like oil and water, or milk and food coloring and oil and all this stuff. Like, that's fun. And it's fun to be able to explain that to your classmates, and kids feel really proud of themselves, and then they love to blow their parents' socks off. That's another thing.
The kids feel proud of themselves. I think that's the key. I was going to ask you, what did the children say, you know, after these sort of along the way, for example, that project, and then after the culmination, what is that experience like? So they're proud, which is awesome.
Yeah, there's a lot of hugging. Yeah, there's a lot of hugging and high fives, and sometimes like parents putting their kids in a headlock, like a proud headlock. Like, okay. Oh, your brain, you did it. But I think it has to do with, like, for us, we try to create an opportunity to share the learning that is intimidating to the student at first. But that we provide enough support and rehearsal and practice and feedback and encouragement so that they can feel really successful when the real thing happens. Because that is the cycle that we want them to experience. We want them to experience, and this goes to Josh's work, we want them to experience like challenge, nervousness, a little bit of doubt, and then like perseverance and success. Yeah. And like when they, you know, sometimes there is failure involved, but like over time, as you have relationship, kids learn that that's not the end. Yeah. We want them to experience that multiple times so that when they encounter other opportunities that might be new or something they have never done before, or content that feels really foreign, that they're like, oh, I remember feeling unsure before. And then I remember how proud I was when I did it, and I know it's possible.
Right. Yeah, there's something I heard in what you said that I just wanted to sort of point out here real quick, and that is, you know, the challenges of learning, you know, the student is kind of being guided and almost coached towards taking on some learning challenges and moving through them, which is, you know, very much how the world works, right? I mean, that's, you know, in my life as an adult, there are many ways in which I've moved myself forward in work and, you know, in business and things, because I saw a challenge and was like, I'm going to take this on. And that's something I've had to learn over the last, you know, I'm 34 now, and that's sort of like the last 10 years of my life have been learning how to be comfortable with that, because many of my, you know, foundational educational experiences, K-12, even in college a little, were here, we're going to give you the challenge and you can be nervous about it, But, you know, I wasn't the one taking it on. It was just kind of being given to me. And so I think there's a really important social emotional learning that's just happening embedded that is a lifelong, you know, development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's failing in service of the project, right? Of a greater learning opportunity and experience that they themselves have chosen and are wanting to create. And yeah. I think, like you said, Allison, the important part of that too is it's not, you know, we studied a unit for a week, you have a test or quiz, you fail it or you pass it, you move on. This is an iterative process. And so I'm wondering if you could just talk about how those quote unquote failings actually become those learning opportunities for students and how you fostered the idea of things being iterative. Because that's really, to me, at the basis of creativity and ingenuity is the ability to fail in the process of learning.
Mm-hmm. I think that the way that in our context that we've been able to do that most effectively is by making sure that we save time that our last week for like rehearsal, trial, feedback, drafting, and renewing. Because if it's so hard, I know that from anybody who's had classroom experience knows that there's always the like temptation to let the first draft go all the way up until it's due. But then you never get that opportunity to improve, to scrap, to start over, to try again. And so it's by being disciplined about saying like, nope, we are going to reserve time for kids to like show each other's work at the stage that it's in right now. And to do that soon enough so that there can be real feedback given. Not doing it so late that we just have to say like, it's going to be great. And because we're presenting in 20 minutes and we don't want to tell the kid that it's not ready like 20 minutes before they go. You have to do that far enough in advance so you can say like, you know, and not the teacher, so that a peer can say like, that is disorganized. I do not understand your point. They will just say it. Right. Right. You teach them language and stems to help them give and receive feedback, but you like, leaving the space, that's something that adults can offer kids in a PBL environment. We do have some control over the time, so we can offer the space for them to get feedback that tells them this is not ready yet, but then the cushion is there for them to try again and try to improve their work.
There's also power in that give and take amongst peers, right? Is that it's not just the teacher being the one saying, yes, no, this is good, this is what we're aiming for. It's giving the opportunities for you to give feedback, like you said, to your peers, but also to receive feedback that you know is meant to help to improve your product, that they don't have they're not trying to have the end result be anything other than something that they can experience themselves and enjoy that final product together.
Yes, it really does invest them in one another's work. And sometimes you know, if a kid or anyone is self-critical, you can't always really see or appreciate your own progress or improvement because you might still want it to be better. But it might be easier to recognize that in someone else's improvement and to feel a lot of pride in knowing that you coached them through that. I definitely, and some kids, you know, every person, there's like that, trying to think of the, I'm sure you know, the End of Normal, what is that book? Todd Rose, I think. I don't know, you guys can look it up. But it basically talks about how there's no such thing as really being normal. And we all have a jagged profile of strengths and weaknesses. And so some kids really do take to coaching one another really quickly. And they can like quickly see their words of feedback having a positive impact on their peers' work.
Yeah.
And they feel really proud of that. So then they feel proud of their classmate for doing better. They feel proud of themselves for having helped with that. And that builds that sense of community and wanting to share excellent work with others, because they realize that it's not only their own, that they don't only impact their own work, but they have an impact on their peers' work as well.
I think that's amazing. And I think it's interesting you mentioned coaching, because I feel as someone who's gone through coach training, a lot of coach training is just teaching adults to just wait a minute before they say something, you know, and it's a lot of unlearning of, years of, I think, just sort of this conditioning of how to operate. So I'm curious how, what it's like from the teacher's perspective as they're watching the students develop these skills. What do the teachers learn from the students, or how do the teachers feel as they're, you know, watching this unfold, either where it's going really well or where they need to sort of intervene or course correct?
Yeah, I think that's, I would love to invite you, Michael, to come and you can coach us on coaching the kids coaching.
Sounds good. We can talk about that.
but I think that that's definitely a learning process, and you get better at it over time. Yeah. But I think it's also about having the goal in mind, mm-hmm. and what you said about learning to keep your mouth closed, like providing, you've created a culture of feedback, mm. and then you've provided some sort of support for kids to give one another feedback, mm. and then within bounds, you let that happen. And as the adult, like with a large amount of responsibility for the space, if you really see it going left, you have to be like, no, we're gonna stop. We're gonna stop right there. Like when the kid says, I don't mean to be offensive, but I'm like, right. that's your conscience telling you that you are about to be offensive. So like, you want to run that by me, and then we can talk about how to say it, and then you can try it. Like, you have to be willing to jump in, mm-hmm. but a lot of it is willing to watch and mm-hmm. and allow the kids to give feedback on the feedback. And
yeah.
Yep, it's just about, so it takes patience and time. But if you've created that space in order to really allow that feedback to be authentic,
yeah,
then the growth will happen.
Mm-hmm.
I think that kind of is an interesting way to segue, because all of these things that you've been talking about kind of, I feel like, led you to being a founding member of CapEx. And so I'm curious how you see that direct line in your own journey from teacher, from PBL instructor to founding member of a charter school here in DC that's hopefully going to be up and running within the next little while, hopefully.
I think that willingness to fail forward is important in making that shift. And getting joy out of the process mm-hmm. and not just the final product, and knowing that like it can take a really long time, but you're learning along the way and there are small milestones that are meaningful. Those things are true in a PBL classroom and are also true in the school founding journey. So
if you're, about failing forward. I like that.
Yeah. So for us, whether it's the piloting process where we've done programming with kids on as small a scale as like an afternoon after school to a single Saturday to 4 weeks of summer school, being willing to try some things and learn from them and move on, that's key. Like one experiment that we tried, this was fun, that really flopped. we think that building background knowledge is really a key to increasing student engagement, because when kids have something to connect new knowledge to, they're more likely to have questions or being willing to go deeper. So we were trying to think about how we could test that or show that in our winter pilot, and we said like, oh, maybe we could, we know we're doing all this background knowledge work on Saturdays because it was full day Saturday learning experiences. Maybe we'll set up a Google Classroom page with like no, and we will really tie nothing to it. Well, like there's no like assignment, there's no expectation that you finish stuff, but we'll just like post related content there. And if we see kids are exploring that and using it during the week, then we've kind of shown this connection between building background knowledge and then that like creating curiosity and further engagement. Well, if you don't, it didn't work. It didn't work because it didn't connect back to their project. They didn't, and we also like weren't using Google Classroom for anything else. It was just like this extra thing stuck on the side, and it didn't work. But that's okay. We took that learning, and it wasn't the only thing that we tried that winter. And the kids had really great projects that they were proud of, and we took that and didn't do the Google Classroom experiment in quite the same way in a future pilot. So from a small scale like that to you know, writing the charter application and not getting approved the first time and just saying like, well, gotta try again. Take the feedback, figure out where we've been pushed to improve and go from there.
And can you talk a little bit about, because again, PBL is just one small part of CapEx, mm-hmm. right? So can you talk more about the broad vision? Because I love, sure. I love what the goals and vision for CapEx are.
Sure, so CapEx is both project-based and place-based. And it's really about immersing kids in the community learning spaces of our city. So including the Smithsonian and all the great museums that we have here in DC, many of which are free, but also the places that might not be a museum, but that are rich learning opportunities for kids. So that looks like, for example, when we did our summer pilot on solar energy in the grid, one of the things we did was a solar energy scavenger hunt in Columbia Heights, and the kids had a map and some clues, and we found all sorts of different ways that solar panels were improving life in our community, from the parking meter to the bike share to the speed cameras. There were like bonus points if you found solar panels that were not on the list. So some kids, there's a gas station at the corner of 14th and Euclid, which has solar panels on the roof, which the kids found. We didn't know those were there. So like that's a small thing. And like the deep, that's not necessarily building deep science content knowledge, but what it is doing is creating an experience that kids will remember, that tells them that like this technology that then we're like reading about really abstractly and doing some diagrams of and talking about like movement of photons from this part of the solar cell to that all of that has real life application. And they know because they went and found like 8 spots within a 2-block radius where this technology was making some sort of difference. So that type of immersion in the community, talking with organizers who helped communities form a solar co-op so they could get cheaper prices for solar panels on their own roofs, to having grid alternatives come in and do a mock solar panel install with the kids. All of those experiences then help build a sense of agency in the kids, a sense of belonging in their community. And like those pieces really motivate them in their project work, which is where the academic competencies develop. So for us, it's really a whole person experience that focuses on engaging the kids and building their social emotional competencies as they're doing these meaningful projects. We know that if they do the projects, the academic learning will happen. And then the agency and belonging are what allow the kids to actually use those academic skills in their futures.
I love it. I think that's really exciting as we think about reimagining education and what education can look like. You know, when you talk about the community being almost your extended playground, extended school grounds, you know, so it when you talk about the Smithsonian's and even just the gas station that became part of the class assignment that they created themselves, I think it opens up a broader world to students to see that learning happens everywhere, not just in a classroom.
Mm-hmm. It's just like what Michael was saying about K-12 versus like the past 10 years of his life and having to invest in learning to say yes to certain challenges. For us, we feel like when you graduate from school, you're not learning in a classroom anymore. And so if we restrict learning to the classroom for like throughout your K-12 experience, then we're not really setting you up to learn effectively outside the classroom afterwards. Sure, some kids are learning how to do that along the way, maybe from their, you know, humans are natural learners, and some parents are really great at supporting that in their kids, and some kids have a lot of opportunities to learn outside of school in different after-school programs, but not every kid has those outside of school opportunities. And so for us, we really want to break down this artificial barrier between the classroom and the outside world, and just say, you know, like, the you take your brain everywhere, and so we want you to remember to, and the rest of your body, Michael, you take your whole learning self everywhere. You take your whole learning self everywhere, and so don't forget that you can use that, and you can be learning no matter where you are, and that it's up to you to notice the opportunity that excites you, and to be like, hey, I'm excited, and then realize, like, oh, I can do something about it, that there's something to learn here, there's something that I could take from this and then hopefully share with other people.
Yeah, there's cognition happening everywhere in the body. Just a little nuance there that I was hearing in what you were saying that sort of like just little thing of like, how does the real world reward people, right? And the real world rewards people for doing, in terms of what we're thinking about when we talk about school often, which is career and work. But even in life, you know, the real world rewards people who are, you know, people that are helpful to each other, people that are empathetic, who can see more than just what's right there in front of them, and who also, you know, do good work and take on challenges. Because in general, that's, you know, more and more and more what jobs are requiring. It's not so much this, you know, regimented, there are not regimented factory jobs in the sense that there were when school was created in this country as mandatory. So it's kind of cool. And, you know, it kind of brings me to this question of, you know, within CapEx or even more broadly in education in, you know, the city of Washington, D.C., in the country, in the world, or just in general, what are you most optimistic about seeing become a part of school and learning?
Mm-hmm. I want to pause that really important question for a second and go back to what you said about what the world or the real world rewards people for.
Yeah.
And just also name that a real challenge is also that the world doesn't reward everyone equally. Different people experience different outcomes from similar behaviors based on racism and systemic issues. And so a huge part of the social emotional learning piece also has to be identity work that's happening for everybody, for all students, teachers, because sometimes we're going to see evidence of that happening across history. When we're in a museum, we might see evidence of that, like through a protest that we encounter if we're walking from our place of learning to somewhere else. Kids are experiencing that like through their own life stories also. And it's about like building sense of self, role models, people who have dealt with that in the past and worked through it, and a sense of community support, so that when inequitable things happen, like kids have some language for it, and they don't internalize it, and they have people to call on, text to go to, other things to try to say, like, this is not how I want the world to be. But what the issue is like with what's happening outside, the issue is not with me. So that's like, for us, one of our design elements is, for us, we call it social emotional learning and identity work. We always put those together because we think that you can't, like, in the United States, social emotional learning is incomplete without real investment in identity building and role of understanding how our identity affects our experience.
Yeah.
That's really powerful, because I think you're absolutely right in terms of not just the identity of yourself and your community, but the systems you talked about too. Mm-hmm. Right? So even education being a system that was used as a tool to suppress, to make inequities throughout the country, And so I think as we address that, as we think about where education can go, we can't go anywhere without addressing where we are and where we've come from. So I think you're absolutely right. That's a really, I love that you brought that up too.
And it has to, I think it also, it's really important to us because we do value place-based learning. And for us, place includes the natural world, but also the built world. And that's affected by humans who like have cultures and like leave both good and bad marks wherever they go. and so we just like, it's really important to us that we offer some sort of language and tools to teachers and kids to explore like themselves, but also the places that we're learning in, and to recognize what some of the different factors are, whether it's systemic forces, cultural, what like all the different things that are at play. Like we hope that kids gradually grow in their awareness of what's happening around them, so that they can then like grow into their agency as actors in that environment, and then as people who can change it.
Can you give some examples of some of the systemic issues of injustice that you kind of prepare the students for or use as examples?
Sure. So it can be smaller, big. There's a lot, right? So, I don't know if this is the best example. I'm thinking of a couple different things, but sometimes things that one person does not experience as an injustice or a problem are experienced that way by someone else. So for example, running into like a large group of other young people who might be visiting from out of town, who might be wearing MAGA hats like outside of the African American History Museum, might be really difficult to process for some students who are not expecting to see that and who associate those hats with a negative view of themselves and their culture and their family. And so part of it is just like preparing kids during morning meeting or at reflection and storytelling, which is what we do at the end of every day. Preparing kids for like things that we might see, and then teaching some like body awareness to be like, when I feel upset, I might notice this happening. Right. And like, this is what I can do about it. You know, and like, here's my safe person who I can talk to, or here's the breathing strategy. Or if I'm like really panicked about something, I should let the adult know and we can regroup and pause. Yeah. So that's not exactly answering your question, Michael. So there's like that thread of just preparing kids to encounter things that we see. There's the critical analysis thread of like, actually, how do you design an experience in a place that's been curated to engage with the content that's on the walls? Sometimes the content really already is doing that critical work. Like one of our favorite exhibits ever at the National Portrait Gallery included Titus Kaphar's work and about unseen past and all of these great works of art that talked about or illustrated the ways that lives of famous white Americans have often like obscured or covered the lives of people of color. And he really explores that theme in his artwork. And so that opens the door for those conversations with kids. Then there's other exhibits you interact with, which don't have that critical lens. And so you bring that with you. And you still want to take like, what does it tell us about ourselves, this story that's here, and how might, you know, what could we add to change the way that to change the story? So there's that piece. And then there's the piece about being really intentional with the experts who we work with to give like information, feedback, content to kids, and putting in, like if you just randomly Google, you might end up with a disproportionate representation of white people.
Yeah.
And you don't want to do that. Like that's not responsible. When you're thinking about like one of the things that research shows about stereotype threat and its impact on kids' performance is that when students know about people who share their identity, who have faced similar challenges and have navigated them successfully, the effect of stereotype threat diminishes. So for us, that means like when we're thinking about who our guest speakers who we're going to invite in or who we're going to put on the panel to judge a student's work, we try to have a diverse representation of identities. We do want to make connection across difference, and we don't want to say to kids that just because someone is different from you that like you don't have things for each other. Like I'm a white teacher and like I have to do work with my identity, but I also want to have meaningful relationships with the kids, and we can do that across difference. But it's also important for us to make sure that like some of the scientists that we bring to talk to kids about their topic, like that those are people of color who have confronted some systemic obstacles that our students are also likely to encounter and who can share a little bit from that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you're kind of I think in what you're saying, you're looking to kind of just prevent the children from being robbed of that type of learning, of that sort of integrated, not just social emotional, but like you said, that identity, right? And giving them a plethora of, identities that they may relate to, not just what, a lot of school is focused on, which is the content itself. It's kind of, you're looking to blend that, which I think is really, really important.
Yeah. Do you want me to go to your question about optimism?
That's up to you. I think this is an important topic too. If there's any, you can share more or we can go on or both.
I think that's it on that topic, but there's always more to say there, and we're learning. We're still learning a lot there.
And appreciate that you bring that up too. I think that was right on with where it need to go. And I think that you're right in that while we're amplifying optimism, we have to also amplify truth and amplify what is already out there and what we are working to bring to another level or bring to a new understanding or really just be able to grow from both the good and bad and be open and honest about the fact that there are aspects that are challenging that we need to address if we are to really be able to be optimistic.
Yeah, Bryan Stevenson is one of my big role models in terms of like being real about what's out there and then also retaining hope and knowing like how important that hope is for sustaining energy to keep working.
Agreed.
Yeah. I like it. I feel like that could be a whole other podcast down the road is leading rather with PBL next time, leading with, identity and social justice. So that's just putting that idea out there. Something, for me that is just a part of my experience in education that I don't know that I'm nearly as much of a, not expert, but familiar with as much as I'd like to be. So I appreciate you sharing all that. So even within that context or the project-based learning and all of it, where do you see hope or where do you see optimism and things playing out over time and with your work and in education?
It's with the kids, obviously.
That's good.
Obviously.
I mean, it needs to be said though, right? So thanks for saying it. Yes, yes. It's why we're here,
kids,
right?
It's why we're here. It's why their energy. I think that it's a tremendous gift and privilege and responsibility that we receive from children, because many of them are so willing to go on an adventure with adults and they will try what you ask them to, they'll try to do what you ask them to do. And so we have a really big responsibility to try to make whatever it is that we ask them to do as meaningful as possible. And that like we create that task that includes space for them to begin to set their own tasks also.
Yeah.
So to that point then, what in your mind, should we be asking them to do?
Yeah, that's the whole question of education right there. What should we be asking? What should we be asking the kids to do? Yeah. Every day, every year, every minute. That's what keeps us all up at night.
And just to sort of piggyback on that and add to that, you know, what you said, Allison, of, you know, when we, especially when there's rapport, when you ask a child to do something in school, they try to do it. And that's kind of maybe a bigger responsibility that many adults and teachers have that they might not realize just how significant it is that, like, the kids will do what they ask them to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that we have an opportunity. We have a responsibility to narrate over, like, whatever opportunity we're offering to kids, what it is and why we're asking them to do it. And then to give them the space to reflect on it afterwards, because then even in our humanly limited capacity, and like when none of us can design the perfect learning experience, if we give the space for the kids to reflect afterwards, like we at least allow them to say like what is working, what is not working, what they got out of it, and then we can learn and move forward together. So I think that, you know, we're all trying like to offer experiences that are meaningful and memorable for students that also like lead to the type of learning that they can leverage to achieve their goals in the future. But I think that part of what we need to do is always have that space to say to the kids, like, how was this for you?
Yeah,
I think the collaboration is really crucial, right? It's, if we are to reimagine and rethink education, it can't just be dictated to the next generation of learners, mm-hmm. next generation of leaders, next generation of thinkers. It has to come from and in collaboration with and together in the context of what can learning be and what can school look like or help us to achieve and what do we want to be able to get from this educational journey and this educational experience.
Yeah, and so for me, I think like that collaboration, that I think it's important to say that, and that means that like teachers do have something to offer and we don't have to like totally disappear. And right. We should offer to the kids things that we know how to do or books that we know are interesting that they might also be interested in, or like, you know, specialized training in like Wilson reading or other things that can like help a kid overcome a learning challenge that they've had. We don't need to hold back what we do know or what we've learned in order to just make space for them to do it all by themselves. It really is about collaborating and like, you know, 2 feet, like the teacher's foot, the kid's foot, the teacher's foot, the kid's foot, and like that we can walk forward.
I love it. Here's a question. This is kind of like a little bit of a tangential question, but it's just a quick one. I'm just thinking about like parents in all of this and parents who might not quite yet be seeing the process that you're taking the kids through in collaboration of that one foot in front of the other together. You know, how is that with parents that might not quite get it right away?
Yeah. So at CapEx, one of our design elements, like I mentioned before, social emotional learning and identity work, one of our other design elements is what we call shared learning outcomes. Hmm. And that is about using language that's as clear as possible to have kids and parents or families and teachers on the same page about what we're trying to learn. Mm. And when we use that type of language, then we can collaborate more effectively. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of like mm-hmm. the project and the goal.
Yeah.
And parents are also a great barometer for quality. Like if they think that the project is a waste of their kids' time, you should probably listen. And it might not be, but there might be something underneath their concern that is telling you, like, maybe this project needs to be more rigorous. Maybe you need to do a better job explaining how it's going to build skills that are relevant in the real world. Maybe you need to redesign some aspect of it. So
yeah.
For us, it's about sharing what is the learning outcome in a way that is as understandable as possible. And that's not as opaque as something like fifth grade math, which is just a label that doesn't tell any of us really what we're working on.
Right. Well, and I hear in there too, there's a little bit of, the parent, just some coaching of the parents to suss out, what is it that's really happening? And like you said, coaching is a two-way street, right? So, the parent might actually have a point that you're like, oh, right. Okay. Yeah. Actually, we should go back and incorporate that. Or the parent might walk away feeling, oh, I get it now. I just needed that a little extra piece of information.
Families and parents are your most valuable partners as teachers. They know their kids so well, and their kids, many parents hear so much from their kids about what is going on in the classroom.
Yeah.
And if you can if you can develop trust so that the communication is open,
yeah,
and parents aren't afraid to give you negative feedback, then you will actually grow better, and the kid will get what they need. You can find out about conflicts that are happening in the class way in advance. Yes. But there has to be open communication, and the parent has to know that you really value their input, and you recognize that the specialized knowledge that they have as the person in that student's life.
Well, yeah,
I was just going to say real quick, for parents or teachers or educators who are not in a community now where that's happening, I think it's important to remind them that this is all in the framing before it even starts, that this is going to happen. Because I think there are a lot of schools out there where if I were a teacher listening to that, collaboration between parents, student, and teacher, I'd be like, that's not possible. Like, what's the point? That's not going to happen. But that's the community needs to be set up in the framing of that, I think, for that to show up in a school. It sounds like you've done that. So it's showing up and it happened.
It's really, I think it's really credit to the Flamboyant Foundation, who's done great work across DC. And they taught me how to do family engagement.
Yes, they're terrific.
I didn't pop out knowing how to do some of those things, but they do a lot of work with schools, working with teachers to build skills and to help teachers develop mindsets of openness and to realize a family doesn't owe you any trust. You got to build that. So
yes, right.
Flamboyant I'm really grateful to them for Flamboyant their work.
Yeah. And opening up to larger caregiving community, right? So we've been using parents, but I think it's a stand-in for caregivers and those who are in service of the student. And it goes back to what you said originally, which is why we're all here, right? So if we're transparent with parents and the larger community and the caregiving community and those that come into contact with our children every day, then we can create that community that are constantly and collaboratively, like we've said, working together in service of the student and in service of our children. And how do we engage, like you said, the larger community, which involves the crossing guards, the bus drivers, the metro workers, the staff at the school, to be able to all have this common goal of how do we engage our students to get their learning journeys to be what they want them to be. And so I think that I love that, as you said, as one of your core principles and core elements of CAPX, and just knowing you, just you in general, and that's something that I think you value. And so I think that that's important. And I love the fact that you did give the shout out there to Flamboyant and the work that them and others do to help teachers get those skills. Because like you said, we need to keep learning and growing and adapting our own skills if we want to truly be able to improve and make the most difference in the lives of our students and children that we want to see.
It's true. Yep.
Well, as we are getting close to our time here, which is sad because I could talk about this stuff and hear from you, Allison, that's just why we have to do that other episode down the road. But if you were to think about 1 year, 5 year, some point in the future where you've, gone through some work, you've done a lot of this stuff, you've grown, you've changed, education has changed, looking back, what are some of the things that are different that you're seeing as those seeds that are growing over time and making education better?
Yeah, I think that we would see more time in more schools consistently given to social emotional learning and wellness I think that that is something that happens in pockets now, but isn't everywhere. And I am hopeful. I'm hopeful that that might be one of the positive outcomes of COVID, just because I think there's a big push for that now. There's momentum building around that, and we needed it before. But I'm hopeful that we might see that afterwards. I'm also hopeful that we will see more of a focus on, when we do have kids in school, how is what we're doing really a part of this continuum of anytime, anywhere learning? And how is what we're doing not only developing the kids in that moment with whatever the specific content goal is, but how is it also preparing them for future experiences of anytime, anywhere learning? Which may be because of a pandemic, or maybe because they are, you know, after school and they encounter something that they want to learn. Like the same set of skills can move them forward. So I'm hoping that we are, we have a new focus on that as a learning outcome from anything that we are putting in front of children.
Yeah. Love it. I love that. Learning anywhere, learning everywhere. I mean, there was amazing progress has happened in the world even when there wasn't school. So it's kind of like recognizing that learning is learning and being a part of that rather than trying to dominate it or limit it. Yeah, I love that. Thank you.
Yeah, I just want to open it up to you now, Allison. Is there anything else just that you wanted to share with us, or just things in general, that other optimism that you would like to amplify here?
Oh, there's so much. I feel like if anybody who's, I'm sure that most people who are listening are already on teacher Twitter, but I would say Twitter gets a bad rap for being a place where people spew a lot of hate, but I have learned a lot and been encouraged by other educators who I've connected with through that platform. And like people, you know, some of those contacts have turned into real life contacts.
Yeah.
And so I'll just say that that's another mechanism for amplifying optimism. And if any people listening have resisted because they feel like it's going to waste their time or just be a place of hate, know that it doesn't have to be that way. And there's a lot of learning and potential for community that you can find with other educators there.
Allison, what is your Twitter handle so that I and our listeners can follow you?
Oh, it's at @AMG_teach.
@AMG_teach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you'll see the little avatar.
I see that.
Yeah, a little blue stick figure. I drew her. Does she look like me?
Exactly like you. I mean, same outfit, same
uncanny
eyes, same hair.
Yeah.
Terrific. Well, Allison, this has just been so wonderful. And again, I think we all kind of feel the same way, that if we just kept rolling for another hour, two, three, we could keep filling it with amazing conversation. And so I think that's what's so exciting. And really, this has just been a true treasure and a real treat for us. So thank you so much for being our inaugural guest and for being our guest in general on our podcast here.
Thank you to our listeners. We hope you enjoyed this episode and that Allison gave you some food for thought about project-based learning, community learning, social-emotional learning, and identity formation, and more. Again, you can reach Allison on her Twitter handle, @AAllison, MMary, GGilmeister, _teach, AMG_teach. For more information on the Amplifying Optimism podcast, visit our website, www.amplifyingoptimism.com. Join us next week, where we dive into concepts of human flourishing, positive psychology, and how to help all students to find and pursue their passions with Nicole Weston, our guest from Templeton Academy. Keep on amplifying optimism in education and beyond.